Is there anyone here that thinks it's a good idea for him to go back there?
Connell spoke.
I don't really want to be Count, so no.
Thanks, said Matt wryly.
Mordecai grew serious.
You realize there's a good chance you could be killed, alone on another world, and we'd never even know what happened to you. Have you thought about the consequences for your family?
In point of fact, he hadn't really considered it fully from that angle, but he knew it wouldn't change his mind.
I'm sorry, Father. I know it would be a hardship for everyone, but I can't turn my back on Desiccus. That's not who you raised me to be. If I obeyed and left the egg there, I wouldn't be the person I want to believe I am.
Penny covered her face briefly with her hands.
I can't believe this is happening.
She seemed to crumple inward for a moment, but when she uncovered her face it was calm and resolved.
Fine. If this is what you're going to do, then we'll do our best to make sure you survive.
Mordecai stood.
All right, Connell, Irene, you're excused. The rest of the family meeting is for adults only.
Karen looked at him, wondering if she should rise. The Count grimaced.
No, you stay, Karen, if you would.
The two youngest Elenials filed out of the room reluctantly, knowing they were about to miss something interesting. Karen looked to Matthew, but he merely shrugged his shoulders. He was as clueless as she was. Once Irene and Connell were gone, Penny got straight to the point.
You've both said several times that you're just friends, but a number of rumours have begun circulating around the castle.
Karen blushed her odd shade of purple at this, and Matthew opened his mouth, but she held up her hand.
Let me finish. We aren't really worried about the rumours, but rather whether you intend to court Karen or not.
Matthew glared at Moira across the table, which caused her to exclaim,
Why does everyone always look at me? I had nothing to do with this.
Mordecai intervened.
What really brought this on was a story heard from one of the castle maids.
Matthew and Karen waited. Neither had any idea what he was referring to.
A while ago one of them found the bedsheets rumpled and mussed in the family rooms within the castle. They know very well that we aren't actually using those rooms, and the two of you were seen entering there, alone. Add in the fact that both of you have been hiding away from everyone lately, and people have started to put two and two together,
explained Penny.
Karen protested, I was just reading. I'm not used to being around so many people here. I needed time alone, and I just went to check on her. We started talking, and I was worn out, so I fell asleep. Nothing happened,
finished Matt. Mort and Penny looked at one another, and then Mort spoke.
So, you're saying there's nothing between the two of you?
Of course not,
insisted Matt, perhaps a little too forcefully. Karen winced slightly at his tone, a fact not missed by Penny's sharp eyes. Penny's features softened slightly when she looked at Karen, and then she turned her focus to her son.
You've never been much for dishonesty, she said. So, if you tell us that, I believe you. More importantly, though, are you considering anything more in the future? You're both of an age to think about these things.
Matthew was mildly shocked.
Wait, what?
His father leaned in.
There's no shame in it, son. She's asking if you're thinking of courting her. If so, we can easily dispel any rumours hanging around the two of you.
Karen had gone beyond embarrassment and into some place where she was merely a spectator. She was almost paralysed, and yet still fascinated with the conversation. She desperately wanted to leave, but she also was curious how Matthew would respond. Matthew glanced at Karen, uncertain, and perhaps looking for guidance, but when he could read nothing on her blank features, he addressed his parents.
Look, I'm not sure I'm ready to consider any of this. I know I'll have to get married some day, but it isn't really something I'm thinking about right now. So the thought of courting someone isn't on my mind at all. I mean, sure, if I was going to, I wouldn't have any real objection to Karen. She's nice enough and all, but...
He never quite finished, for Moira interrupted.
Matthew, don't be such an ass. Nice enough. What kind of thing is that to say in front of her?
Mordecai was shaking his head, but Matthew responded first.
What? I don't know how to say these things. I'm saying she's nice. She's pretty. I'm not insulting her. Enough, Matthew,
ordered Penny.
We should have talked about this with you beforehand.
She spoke to Karen.
I apologize for my son's lack of tact.
Karen stood, painfully aware of their eyes on her.
May I be excused?
Penny nodded.
Of course.
Before she could say more, Karen vanished, teleporting directly from where she stood.
That went well,
muttered Mordecai.
Moira rose. It was awful and incredibly rude. How could you put her on the spot like that?
Penny nodded.
I agree. I'm talking about you,
exclaimed their daughter. Then she turned her eyes on her father.
And you! Matthew just made it worse, but you should have expected that.
Well, I didn't mean for it to really go down this path exactly, but...
began Mordecai.
Moira started for the hall. I'm going to go find her.
Penny left after that, and Matthew and his father were left alone in an awkward silence. Finally, Mordecai broke it, asking,
What are you thinking?
That it would be really handy to be able to teleport like that,
said Matthew.
Mort laughed. Ha! It would. Especially since we're left with the dishes.
They both grimaced at that. Chapter 41 Karen stared down from the top of the main keep in Cameron Castle. She wasn't sure why she had picked that place in particular. She had only been there once before, during the tour of the castle that Graham had given her, but it had seemed like a quiet place. There were one or two guards, but they didn't bother her when she appeared suddenly. They had seen her before, and strange doings were almost common in a castle frequented by most of the wizards in Lothian. She knew things were different in this world, but the conversation with Matthew's parents had been too much.
I am not some prize to be auctioned off, she told herself.
That wasn't what they had really meant, of course, but it had felt that way. Matthew's response to their questions had been even more embarrassing. Then she felt a presence approaching from the direction of the closest stairwell. Unlike the guards, this was a mage. She had discovered the difference early in her stay there. Wizards had brilliant auras. They fairly shone with power compared to normal folk. She debated relocating, but then she identified her visitor. It was Moira.
How did she know I'd be up here?
Karen wondered. The other woman stopped a few feet away from her and leaned on the short ledge between the Merlons, but didn't say anything at first. After a while, Karen spoke.
I looked like a fool back there. You were fine, said Moira, but I'm embarrassed about how my family behaved.
Karen didn't respond immediately. A raven flew up from the courtyard and passed overhead, and the two of them watched it fly until it reached the forest edge.
I think they were just looking out for their son, and maybe sending me a message. A message? I'm a commoner, said Karen bluntly. Your brother explained the expectations that nobility have here.
Moira laughed.
Both of my parents are commoners. I don't think they give two figs for traditional expectations among the ruling class.
Now Karen was confused.
But they're the Count and Countess. Doesn't that mean, well, sure, now they are,
admitted Moira.
But they didn't start out that way. Mom was a cooper's daughter, and she used to work as a maid for the Duke of Lancaster. Dad was technically a noble from birth, but he wasn't raised that way. His father, the one that raised him, was a blacksmith. The only message they were trying to send was to my idiot brother, finished Moira.
And what was that? Asked Karen.
What you heard. They like you, and when they heard the rumors, they were worried that your reputation might be tarnished, since he hasn't shown any sign of wanting to court you in a normal fashion. They probably thought that putting him on the spot would wake him up. What they failed to consider was how he would react, and how that would make you feel, explained Moira. If it makes any difference, they aren't normally that stupid, but they've been under a lot of stress lately. Two of their children vanished, and only recently returned. I started a revolution in a neighboring country, and before that someone kidnapped Irene and murdered several people in the house. It's been an eventful few months.
Karen had heard most of that previously, during her time spent with Irene and Carissa, but it did put the evening's strange events in perspective, somewhat.
I'm not really worried about things like reputation. In my world, things are rather different. Even more importantly, I'm not looking for a husband. Your brother and I are just friends. like we keep telling everyone.
Moira glanced at her for a second, meeting her eyes. What Karen saw there was unsettling, almost predatory. But the moment passed when the other woman looked away.
"You have terrible taste in men," said Moira.
"What?"
"My brother," clarified the other woman. "I can tell you like him, and not as a friend. I just can't understand why."
Karen shook her head.
"That's not true. Didn't you hear—"
Moira cut her off.
"Didn't they warn you? I'm a little dangerous, even for a wizard. My trip to Dunbar changed me, and for the worse. You need to learn to shield your mind better. I can sense things from the others, even when they try their best, but you, you're an open book."
Karen had heard a few things about that, but Matthew hadn't seemed to think it was as bad as his sister was now painting it.
"It's worse than he thinks," said Moira, replying to her unspoken thoughts. "He's just too blind to see past his image of me. My brother is brilliant in his own way, but he's never been very sharp with regards to people."
"He's a little rough," Karen admitted,
"but deep down he's kinder than he lets on."
Moira sighed.
"You should give up on him. He's not a bad person, but he'll make you miserable if you pin your hopes on him."
Karen found Moira's remarks about her brother more than a little irritating.
"I think his actions are more important than how anyone sees him, or whether he bothers to try to sugarcoat his words for people. More than once, your brother has put himself at considerable risk on my behalf."
"Be honest. You know he can be a bit of a jerk sometimes," said Moira, deliberately needling her.
"I'm starting to find it annoying to hear everyone pointing out his flaws. Perhaps if you were less concerned with finding fault, he'd have nicer things to say," snapped Karen.
Moira grinned.
"There it is."
"There what is?"
asked Karen.
"The fire," stated Moira.
"You've got a real thing for him. I just wanted to be sure."
Karen was thrown off balance once again.
"Now, wait, just because—"
She stopped herself, as a few memories that she would rather not share passed through her head. Moira's eyes widened.
"No, I can't believe it. Already? Wow, wait a minute,"
demanded Karen.
"What do you think you know? Or what did you see? That was just a stray moment of the imagination. It's not—"
"Oh, no," said Moira confidently. "I know the difference. Don't worry, though. Your secret is safe with me."
Karen covered her face with her hands.
"It's all right," soothed Moira. "I'm on your side. His too, truth be told. I love my brother, even if we do argue a lot. If anything ever comes of it, I'll support you to my parents, not that you'll need it. They really do like you."
That evening, Matthew was back at it again. His thoughts were occasionally troubled by the morning's family event, but he put it out of his mind the best way he knew how, by focusing on his project. Gary was with him at the moment, having dropped by a few minutes earlier to see what sort of progress he had made.
"Let me show you what I've got so far," said Matt.
Lifting the enchanted metal cubes from the table, he said a few words in Lycian, activating them. They rose in the air and took up their positions, 8 cubes, one at each corner of a now larger cube that was 2 feet on each side. With another word, he switched them into their active state, and the sides became blacker than black.
"I call it the FT," he declared, "the Fool's Tesseract, since it isn't really a true tesseract."
"Nonetheless, it's fascinating," agreed Gary. "What does it do, exactly?" Matthew walked him through an explanation of the translation panes. There were 6 of them now, forming the sides of the cube. He took his time describing how they worked, and then added,
"The interesting thing is that all 6 of them open into the same pocket dimension, and I can control its size."
"Its size?" Matt nodded.
"Yeah. This is the first time I've activated them all at once, but while each opening is 4 square feet in area, they currently open into a pocket dimension that's only 1 inch cubed in volume, each side of it being 1 inch square."
"So whatever enters is being compressed?"
"Precisely," said Matt. "The idea is that whatever they throw at me will become compressed in the much smaller pocket dimension. Then later, when I want to return the favor, I can invert the translation panes and throw everything back at them. Like this."
He uttered the phrase to switch the operating mode of the enchantment. There was a roar, and the world went white, then black. When Matthew opened his eyes again, he was staring up at a starry sky. Turning his head, he almost lost consciousness again as a blinding wave of pain assaulted him.
Feedback sickness? He thought. How did that happen?
Are you awake?
It was Gary's voice. The android was on the ground nearby, beginning to struggle to his feet. Matthew was confused.
What happened?
My sensors recorded most of the event, but the simplest explanation is that your FT exploded, said the machine.
How did we get outside?
We were in the workshop.
Did you drag me out here?
No, said Gary. This is where you landed. As for your shop, there isn't much left of it.
Ignoring the pain, Matthew levered himself up onto his elbows and glanced around. He was in the castle's east courtyard, but his shop was gone. Well, not entirely gone. There were pieces of it all over the yard. Where it had previously stood, the FT was still hanging in the air, having changed colours from black to a shimmering grey.
Well, that's interesting, he observed.
Voices were shouting across the yard now, as guards and other servants began trying to find the cause of the commotion. The next day Matthew spent in bed, resting and trying to get over his feedback sickness. The force of the explosion had been great enough to break his personal shield, but hadn't quite been enough to do him any serious harm after that, other than the scrapes and bruises he had acquired tumbling across the open ground. Thankfully, none of the larger pieces of his workshop had landed on him after the initial blast. He'd had to make a lengthy explanation to his parents and family earlier, and now Moira had come to visit him. She leaned over his bed, looking down with a smirk on her face.
"You blew yourself up again," she greeted him.
"I have a gift," he replied.
"On the bright side, you didn't lose any arms or legs this time," she noted.
Matthew frowned.
"I didn't blow myself up the time I cut my arm off. You're comparing apples and oranges. The head groomsman spent half the night rounding up the horses," she added. "I didn't blow up the stable," he objected. "The blast scared them so badly, some of them kicked down the stall doors," his sister explained. "You really have a talent for mayhem. I'm starting to wish you had gone to Dunbar with me. The whole thing would have been over a lot quicker if you had blown up the city."
He laughed.
"I hear you did just fine on your own. I'm not sure the world could handle it if we both got rowdy in the same geographic region at the same time."
"Try to be more careful next time," she told him, as her face became serious. "At least until I can figure out how to make a copy of you." Then her eyes darted off to one side.
"Father's coming. I think he wants to discuss your design. I'll be going."
She rose and opened the door just as their father reached it. He stepped in and gave her a hug before letting her leave, as was his habit. Then he turned serious eyes on his son.
"What happened?"
Matthew recounted what he knew of the event before adding, "It was what I wanted to happen with the final version, but what I don't understand is where the force of the explosion came from. Nothing was directed at it before I inverted it. There shouldn't have been anything inside to produce that kind of result, other than some air."
"Did you notice anything before you turned it inside out?" asked Mordecai.
"There was a draft in the shop, but it wasn't enough to really make me wonder about it," said Matthew.
"So it was probably drawing air into it the whole time it was active."
"Maybe," Matt admitted. "But what would cause that? There was no attractive force."
"Air pressure," declared Mort. "The interface of your... what did you call it before?"
"Fool's Tesseract." His father chuckled.
"The name was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Anyway, the interface of your translation pane was unidirectional, so it served as if it were effectively a vacuum, even though the space inside it was filling with compressed gas. The ambient pressure was driving air into it. How long was it active?"
"A few minutes at most."
"If it had been longer, you might not have survived. It goes without saying, but you can't test this thing at Castle Cameron any more. In fact, I'm not sure if you should continue working on it at all. It seems extremely dangerous."
Matt's face grew stubborn.
"I'm not giving up on it. Besides, the idea is I'll be inside it, between the translation panes, when it's inverted. Any destruction will occur outside, while the user is completely protected."
"Are you that merciless, son?" said his father.
It sounds as if you intend to offer these people no quarter.
I won't be using it on people, insisted Matthew. Just against those metal android soldiers, hopefully.
Gary says that most of those machines contain the souls of real people, observed Mordecai. If you destroy them, won't it be the same thing? Is there no chance you can talk to them, offer them an opportunity to return the egg without resorting to violence?
Every time I've been there, I was attacked. Without warning, without any attempt at communication. They've never shown any compunction about killing me. They did kill Karen's aunt and her dog. Then they took Karen, and who knows what they planned to do with her. They've forfeited any right to negotiation, said Matthew. If you want me to make it back alive, you shouldn't suggest I try deal-making. All the evidence so far shows that they can't be trusted.
Mordecai sighed. You're probably right. But I wanted to spare you the worst, if I could.
The worst?
The greatest strength allows you to obtain what you want without hurting others. Too often I've been weak, and forced to use powers that were ill-suited to the task at hand. As a result, a lot of people have died, and their deaths are my responsibility. It weighs on you like a heavy stone, and the weight of it can crush your soul. The last thing I ever wanted was for you to experience that. Yet it's already happened to your sister.
Was what happened in Dunbar really that bad? Asked Matthew. Moira seems different.
His father looked down, uncomfortable.
What happened was unfortunate. She did what she had to do, but half a city died for it. The enemy had backed her into a corner. I'm afraid that in your case this is unnecessary. You're putting yourself in the corner. Whatever happens will be entirely due to your decisions.
They started it, protested Matt. They took Desiccus. I won't allow that.
Mordecai looked sad.
Then you'd better be prepared to deal with the consequences. Violence marks the soul, even when done in self-defense. In this case, you'll bear the burden without even that to expiate your actions.
You've really cheered me up,
Matthew answered sarcastically. His father shook his head.
I wasn't trying to.
Chapter 42 Gary was studying the parchment in his metal hands. On it were runes, laid out in elaborate triangular patterns, with occasional notes in Beryon beside them, explaining their function. It was the enchantment Matthew had created for his fool's tesseract. The android pointed to one portion. These are numbers. Matthew nodded. He had already explained each symbol to the AGI in careful detail. Why not just write them as standard numbers? Asked Gary. Why the need to create a separate set of symbols? What makes these figures special, such that they control or focus your magic?
Technically, you're correct, said the young wizard. The runes were created to symbolize different things, but we use them independently of normal words and numbers to help keep things separate in our minds. Otherwise, mages might find themselves performing magic unintentionally while speaking or writing.
But if you or someone else created the runes, what gives them power?
I do, or whatever wizard uses them does.
Gary shook his head.
But what if that other person doesn't know your symbols? Does it still work then?
Depending on the enchantment, explained Matthew. Many of them last forever, and they can be used by people who don't know what they mean.
But to create a new enchantment, the mage must understand the runes they're using, or create new ones that they do understand.
Did you create any of these? Asked the machine.
Actually, yes, said Matt. Translation magic has never been done by humans before. The Elenial Shiha used it, but they had a completely different system called spell-weaving, so I had to create some of those runes from scratch to handle the new concept.
So you create the rune, you imbue it with meaning in your mind, and somehow the universe learns your intention.
You realize how crazy that sounds, observed Gary. It's as though reality is already programmable, much like the programmable matter that the Ansys Project is striving to create. But that's not the strangest part. The strange part is that there's no sign of whoever set it all up originally.
Enchanting? Asked Matthew.
No, declared Gary.
This entire reality, and not just this one. From what you described before, there's an entire multiverse, with some parts of it having Aethar and other parts not having it. Somehow your Aethar expands and spreads, like a living thing, but it hasn't reached everywhere. My world was still dark, as you described it, along with many others.
Well, if Aethar is a result of a change in the organization of the quantum foam, it's just a natural shift, began Matthew.
Gary shook his head. No, not if we're talking about infinities. You say there's no time in the place between realities, but the important thing is this. If this is a one-way process, then everything should already possess the same Aethar. The fact that there are still dark universes means that it isn't a one-way process. In fact, it may mean that there's an active opposition.
An enemy, you mean?
You said you felt a presence when you shift between worlds, like you became part of a greater mind, right? Asked Gary.
Definitely, agreed Matthew.
And it wanted you to spread the light, your Aethar, to these dark worlds.
He nodded.
Mm-hmm. Then in some fashion, you, or perhaps all mages, are agents of this greater intelligence, concluded the machine. And the obverse is probably also true. Whatever it is that has kept your type of reality from becoming the norm everywhere, that force must also have agents. It must be simultaneously changing some worlds back to its preferred type.
Matt gave him a cynical look. You're starting to sound rather mystical.
Gary nodded. I am, aren't I? It's kind of ironic, really. Here I am in a land of magic and mystery, and it's me, the machine, that's positing the existence of gods and devils to explain what he observes. You're the one who should be religious.
The young wizard laughed.
A lot of people are, but when you grow up with a father who is known as the God Slayer, religion starts to seem a little silly. My dad told me it was quite a shock for him when he finally decided that the gods he grew up with were not really gods at all. From my perspective, I tend to view these new agencies you're dreaming up with the same sort of skepticism. I'm not saying they don't exist, but whatever they aren't gods, just more powerful players. It's a matter of scale, just like this war between the nanoscale machines of your world and the Planck-scale magic of mine. Even if these super-intelligent agents of yours exist, there's probably something even larger beyond them, moving them on its game board.
Enough of that, though, said Matthew, hoping to redirect the conversation. You said you had some thoughts about my design.
It's a matter of scale, said Gary. These runes you have here, he pointed at the schematic. Those numbers spell out the dimensions of this pocket dimension you create, right?
Mm-hmm,
agreed Matthew. Then, if you change them, you can alter the size of that pocket dimension, continued the AGI.
Naturally.
Then it's lucky you chose the size you did, or you might have destroyed the castle, Washbrook, and perhaps even a sizable part of the surrounding countryside, finished Gary. That got his attention.
Matt leaned forward.
How? You learned about nuclear weapons on my world and how they were used against the Shi'ar. Being ignorant of physics, you might not have realized it, but if you make the size small enough, it will induce nuclear fusion, even if only a small amount of matter was drawn into it. Any fusion reaction would result in a massive explosion when the energy was released, said Gary.
Matt was stunned, but a thought immediately occurred to him. What if I set this to zero?
That reduces the interior dimension to an undefined singularity, what we would call a black hole in my world's parlance.
And what would that do?
Gary shrugged, an awkward gesture for the military android body to attempt. Ironically, nothing. Once you go that small, when you release it, whatever was inside would be released as a micro black hole. It wouldn't be able to expand or cause damage. Instead, it would be almost unnoticeable, and it would evaporate over a short scale of time.
Oh, said Matthew, noticeably disappointed.
But aside from that, the smaller you go, excluding a singularity, the more devastating the results will be, I think.
Matt arched a brow at him. You think?
There are some exotic states of matter that lie between plasma fusion and a black hole-type singularity. None of them are well understood, so I don't really know what the result would be if they were suddenly released. I'm just guessing that they would be bad, explained the machine.
Then I guess you had better go over these numbers with me, said Matthew, to make sure I don't overshoot my mark.
Angela Kruger, UN President and preeminent leader of the world, was not having a good day. The most recent events involving demon incursions had sent shockwaves through the political sphere, and she was beginning to worry about losing a vote of no confidence. Through most of her term, the job had been routine, almost boring. In the current age of prosperity and technological wonders, most of the age-old drivers of insecurity and turmoil had been vanquished. Poverty was a thing people read about in history texts, disease was laughable, and famine almost impossible. War and the threat of the unknown, the other, was the remaining driver that was now causing her problems. The first demon war had been one of the great motivators behind the strengthening of the UN into the political force it was today. People hadn't been able to upload in those days. The billions who had lived on Earth had been flesh and blood, and with that mortality had come fear. In the years since, uploading and virtual immortality had changed society into something almost unrecognizable. Even the UN had become almost an afterthought, as humans living within the virtual world had ever fewer needs to worry about. It was only now, under threat of another demon invasion, that the UN and its supervision of humanity's main military force had become important once again.
"They're screaming for my resignation, Director Aisman," she told the man sitting across from her. "They walked into a secure facility with impunity, took Dr. Miller's test subject, and then just vanished. Surely you can see how this looks for me. The last thing the people want right now is the appearance of weakness."
"There are other gestures you can make," insisted the defense director. "Fully activating ANSYS is not advisable. We can't be certain we won't be creating a bigger problem than the one we're facing."
"Dr. Miller doesn't seem to share your reservations," observed the president. "And never mind the fact that according to your own evidence, we have a super-intelligent AI agent loose in the network doing God knows what. If the news of that gets out, they'll have my ass for certain."
"I believe the AI has severe restrictions on it. Otherwise, we would likely have been eliminated already," said Aisman. "The safeguards built into ANSYS were not as comprehensive as Gary Miller originally suggested. I'm afraid that we might be burning our house down to kill the spider if we activate it."
"Dr. Miller thinks it may be our only option for eliminating the rogue AI," argued President Kruger.
"There are slower options, safer options," put in Aisman. She laughed.
"Building new CC centers and transferring people into the new servers one by one? That's a joke. Do you know what the public will say if I even suggest such a thing?"
"The original network should have been segmented for safety in the first place," countered Aisman. "You can put out that this is a step forward in that direction. You don't have to publicly release the information on the AI threat."
Angela shook her head. "You think like a military man, Director, but I deal with the public. Something like that won't remain secret, not once we start moving on major initiatives. The truth will out. It always does, and usually in the most embarrassing fashion. No, I've made up my mind. I won't authorize full activation, given your warnings, but I will allow Dr. Miller direct access to the ANSYS network. She will be quarantined with it, unless and until I decide otherwise," pronounced the president.
He nodded. "That will be sufficient.
Let me warn you, though. If there's another incident, I may have to allow her to do as she wishes. If you want to avoid that, make certain I'm not put in that position. Am I understood?"
Director Aisman bowed his head.
"Yes, Madam President."
Chapter 43.
"Are you sure this is safe?" asked Karen. "As safe as houses," replied Matthew. She narrowed her eyes. "Then why do you want me to teleport back to Castle Cameron before you start?" "Just to be certain," he admitted. "It will probably be safe, but I can't guarantee it. I'd rather not have to worry about casualties if I make a mistake."
They were standing on an obscure piece of coastline, though exactly where he wasn't sure. It was the last place they had made landfall after returning from her world. Karen had been able to teleport them there, even though she hadn't known where it was in relation to his home. "And if you injure yourself, who is going to help you? Have you considered that?" she countered. "If I injure myself, there probably won't be enough left of me to scrape into a bowl," he thought wryly. "I'll be in the safest place of all," he told her instead. "Nothing will be able to affect the interior of the cube." By that, he meant the space between the translation panes of the Fool's Tesseract, not the tiny pocket dimension that the translation panes fed external matter and energy into. He'd had some difficulty explaining the difference to her earlier. Eventually, she gave in and left, and he was free to begin his testing. He started by checking the spell inputs. His latest version of the enchantment included a large number of refinements, mainly to enable him to control and alter the properties of the exterior translation panes, as well as vary the size of the pocket dimension they fed into. By controlling those things, he could manipulate the size of the area protected by the FT, as well as the result, when he eventually inverted the translation panes and vented the pocket dimension into the surrounding terrain. The primary danger now was that there might be an unexpected problem with the enchantment he had designed. Including so many things that could be altered and changed during use meant that the enchantment itself was vastly more complex. The primary enchantment formula was relatively simple in comparison, but making it so that it could be altered at a whim introduced an entirely different level of complexity. If he had made a mistake, or if the control elements didn't function as he anticipated, then the results would be catastrophic. "Good thing I didn't make any mistakes then," he told himself. "Of course, if I did, I might not live long enough to realize it." He held out the modified staff in front of him. The floating cubes had been simple and practical, but he had needed more physical space to include all the parameters of his control enchantment. Plus, the staff gave him a very visible reminder of what the exterior dimensions of his cube would be when activated, since it was as tall as the FT would be from top to bottom. 7 feet, he repeated to himself. Plenty of headroom and arm room. Taking a deep breath, he began. "Bree mine. Ilen con sadin lina mertus." The words in Lycian were simple instructions. Mode 5, interior 10, exterior 1, activate. They would set the exterior dimensions to their smallest, 7 feet on a side. The interior pocket dimension at its largest, 1 foot on a side. And only create 5 translation panes, leaving the bottom open so he could stand on normal ground. The metal cube mounted on the top of the staff broke apart, and smaller cubes flew outward to take up positions around him where the corners of the Fool's Tesseract would form. Instantly, he was plunged into darkness as the sides and top of the FT came into being. Softly, he let out the breath he had been holding. Even that test had held some inherent danger. If the exterior dimensions hadn't worked properly, the FT could have been too small, potentially cutting off his head or something equally unpleasant. With the bottom open, he could still sense the external world using his mage sight. Hopefully, this would be all that was necessary during most of his time using the device. The bottom side would only be engaged if he were faced with an extreme threat that required complete isolation. It would also be activated when the FT was inverted, to protect him from whatever the results were when the pocket dimension was vented. That part would be automatic, to prevent him from doing so without properly protecting himself. He decided to test it now. "Rex Taliet Amertus," he pronounced. An ordinary field of force formed below his feet, lifting him 2 inches from the ground as the bottom translation pane sprang into existence. His mage sight was abruptly cut off, but aside from that, he couldn't detect any other changes. If it had worked properly, then the outer sides had reversed their direction, venting the pocket dimension outward. Depending on how much air had gone in, there might have been an explosion, but since he had set the pocket dimension to a size of 1 cubic foot, he hoped the result would be fairly innocuous. "But I won't know for sure until I deactivate the FT," he thought. "I need to be able to sense the outside world." He turned his attention inward, trying to find the sensation he'd had before, when his talent had warned him of danger. He found nothing. He had expected as much. The Elenial gift allowed their Crytek to fight as though they could see ahead into the future, though what they were really doing was seeing into neighboring dimensions, where time was close but slightly ahead. Matthew thought that the same thing might have happened to him during his last journey to Karen's world, when he'd had flashes that warned him before he almost committed a fatal action, but he hadn't figured out how to consciously control the phenomenon. "But surely if it were dangerous, it would warn me before I took down the FT," he thought. That wasn't good enough, though, so he spent several more minutes trying to see beyond his own plane of existence. Still, nothing happened at first, and then he began to get sporadic flashes. What he saw was disorienting and poorly focused, but he thought he saw the outside world clearly for a moment. Assuming it was analogous to the one he was in, then it was safe. He decided to chance it. "Estus," he said aloud, and the enchantment deactivated. The rock-strewn clifftop overlooking the ocean looked none the worse for wear. Even the grass beyond the outer edges of where the FT had been was undisturbed, although the ground beneath him was now bare and level. The upper surface had been absorbed by the bottom face of the FT. "That wasn't so bad," he said to himself. Then he reactivated the enchantment, this time using different variables. He made it larger, decreased the inner dimension's size, and he made sure his other toys worked through the translation panes. Although he couldn't see out, he could still cast magic outward from within. It just wasn't possible for him to aim, not unless he could find a way to master his vision into adjacent realms. He practiced for almost an hour, but finally stopped when his frustration grew too much for him. He wouldn't make any progress unless he could retain a calm frame of mind. Before he left, he decided to try one of the more dangerous settings. "Talto Min, Eilen Stur, Sadin Lin Amertus," he intoned. The FT sprang to life once more, this time enclosing him fully, on all sides and below, but most importantly, he had set the interior pocket dimension to its second smallest setting. If the enchantment had worked properly, the dimension into which the translation panes were funneling air and other matter was of an incredibly small size, something on the order of the width of a human hair. Matthew breathed slowly, trying to keep his heart rate down. With each passing second, he knew more and more air was entering the FT. The final result would depend not only on how small the pocket dimension was, but on how much matter entered it before it was inverted. The longer he waited, the more dangerous it would be. It could be dangerous even when set to a larger size if enough matter entered. The smallest size, the one he didn't dare to test, should create an inner dimension that was even smaller, though still large enough to avoid a singularity, at least according to Gary's calculations. This current size should produce a satisfying explosion, but hopefully not the sort Gary had cautioned him about, where atoms themselves began to fuse together. When he thought roughly 10 seconds had passed, he inverted the enchantment. "Rex Taliot, Amertus." He felt nothing within the cube's enchanted boundaries. The question was, what had happened outside it? Again, he tried to focus his gift to see into the adjacent dimensions and get a glimpse of what the world beyond his protective enchantment probably looked like. Visions flickered in his head, and after a few seconds of confusion, he decided he must be seeing smoke or perhaps dust. Something had happened, but he couldn't judge how severe it had been. His ears felt strange, and he worked his jaw to make them pop. "The air pressure is dropping," he realized. In fact, the air was already getting dangerously thin. It's exiting quickly, driven by the unopposed pressure inside. The only reason he hadn't noticed before was because he had used the FT primarily with only 5 sides activated. "I need to add a filter shield to the interior to prevent air from escaping," he thought, making a mental note. "Assuming I don't die before then." He created an impromptu shield, using a spell to do just that. Then he waited. After what he thought was nearly a quarter of an hour, he checked again, but still he could detect nothing but smoke or some sort of cloud. He began to wish he had crafted something that would clear the air around the FT to enable him to get a better view sooner. For a moment, he considered using a simple spell to try to drive the air away, but he stopped before trying it. If he did anything that drove air from within his protected space outward, he would wind up starving for air, since nothing could enter. Matthew found himself panting. He should have created the air shield at the very beginning. Because of his delay, a large portion of the air had left the FT, leaving him with little air to breathe, air he was quickly exhausting. He would have to deactivate the enchantment or he would suffocate, yet he could still detect nothing but smoke outside. Depending on how bad it was, he might kill himself trying to breathe the air beyond his enchantment when he opened it. He could already imagine what Myra would be saying if she could see his predicament. If he had let Karen accompany him for his testing, she could have easily teleported them somewhere safe.
"Stupid never dies."
That was what his father always said, but it was small comfort, since he usually meant his stupidity would live on, whether his actions got him killed or not. His heart was beating rapidly, and he felt as though he had run a mile. He couldn't catch his breath. He was out of time. Matthew created a firm shield around himself, one that would keep out whatever air was outside, and then gave the command that would deactivate the FT. Estus. The outside world reappeared, and he began falling. The ground had vanished. Flailing his arms, he landed after a drop of nearly 15 feet. His shield turned out to be more important for more than just keeping smoke out, for he landed on a very jagged layer of bedrock. Still panting rapidly, he focused his will and drew on the air, moving it and creating a gust of wind to clear the smoke around him. Nothing happened. Well, that wasn't precise. His spell was working, but the air he was moving was also filled with smoke or dust or whatever it was. Matthew drew on his reserves and pushed harder, moving ever vaster quantities of air. He was beginning to see spots in front of his eyes. Seconds passed, and he began to wonder if he should try shifting to Karen's world. It was either that, or learn to breathe dust. Then, just as he had almost given up hope, sunlight appeared and the air cleared. Desperate, he dropped his shield and drew a lungful, and promptly began to cough. The air still wasn't quite clear enough, but he would survive. He kept up his spell, and soon he began to smell the sea. Hacking and retching as he tried to clear his lungs, he surveyed the landscape around him. It was a humbling sight. The ground he was standing on had been blasted into a crater that stretched some 40 feet across. He clambered up the side and looked out. The ground beyond had been blackened and scoured free of soil and grass for as far as he could see in every direction. The forest on the inland side of him, at least half a mile distant, was on fire, and many of the closest trees appeared to have been knocked over. "Shit," he muttered inanely. Then he began to laugh. To any outside observer, he would have looked like a madman. But even as he giggled, he was mentally taking notes. The air problem had been serious, but he could solve that. He carefully began inscribing a circle on the ground. It was time to go home.
Chapter 44 Karen was standing outside the transfer house when he arrived.
"You weren't waiting here for me this entire time, were you?" he asked.
She smirked.
"Would you feel guilty if I was?"
He might, but he wasn't about to admit it.
"You already know the answer to that."
She shook her head.
"You're incorrigible." "No, I was in the keep. I sensed your arrival and teleported over as soon as you got here."
She gave him a thorough once-over with her eyes.
"What do you have all over you?"
Drawing closer, she touched him with one finger, and then promptly sneezed.
"Dust? It worked even better than I expected," he told her proudly. "If it had gone the way you described, there wouldn't be dust all over you," she remarked. "You realize I'm coming with you when you go to my world, don't you?"
He winced inwardly. He didn't want to bring anyone this time, but he couldn't find a way around bringing her. Karen's gift was just too valuable, especially since he would arrive at some random location. She frowned at his hesitation.
"Don't you?"
It was technically a question, but her tone made it clear there was only one acceptable answer. Matthew sighed.
"I do. Although I won't lie. If there was any way to do it without you, I would, no matter how angry you became."
That statement was enough to aggravate her, and it showed on her features. He was still filled with adrenaline from his recent brush with death, though. On impulse, he reached out, sliding his hand behind her neck, and pulled her in for a firm but sudden kiss. His action surprised him almost as much as it did her.
eyes wide, she stepped back.
What was that?
He fumbled for an answer he didn't have, before finally sputtering,
For luck.
She gave him a sidelong glance.
Luck, huh? You're the one who's going to need it, not me. I think you got the custom backward.
They each scanned the yard with both their eyes and maidsight, wondering if anyone had noticed. Being daytime, there were a number of people about, but no one seemed to be staring. Neither of them said anything else about it. Karen was the first to restart their conversation.
You had best be sure that contraption you've created works properly. If we come back from your next rescue mission and I'm covered in dirt, I'll have a lot of explaining to do to your sister.
He missed her point.
Huh? Why? Most of the clothes I've been wearing were hers, she explained.
He still didn't get it.
But they're yours now.
She sighed.
It would be rude if I ruined... Oh, never mind.
There were some things he would simply never understand. They walked back to the keep together. The distance between them was minimal, and for a moment they almost linked arms. But after an awkward glance or two, they decided not to. Karen's mind was still replaying what had just happened, trying to discern whether there was any meaning to it. But when she looked at his features, they revealed nothing. Matthew, for his part, was planning another enchantment.
I may have to bring her, but I don't have to keep her there, whether she likes it or not.
Director Aisman was trying to enjoy a quiet dinner with his wife when the Ansys alert lit up, ruining his peace of mind. The next half hour was a tense one. Interceptors and drones were scrambled, missiles launched, and a short while later, another small piece of terrain was bombed into oblivion. In the aftermath, the reports came in. There had been two anomalous signatures, spaced less than a minute apart, but nothing more. Both had been in the same location. Either the enemy had arrived and left just as quickly, or they had arrived and been destroyed. There was no way to know for sure. He was almost beginning to think he could relax when it happened again, barely an hour after the first time. Their response was the same, and the reports gave no more information than they had before. Another light showed him that the President was waiting for him to answer her urgent call. Chewing his lip, he opened the channel. Lately, his life had become a living hell. Gary was waiting when Matthew emerged from the transfer house, and he handed the young wizard something. It worked again, flawlessly, but there was little doubt of that after the first trial. Always good to double-check things when someone's life is on the line, offered Matthew. The android agreed. In this case, I appreciate that more than you can know. Matt nodded. I intend to make sure we all make it back safely. If you have to make any hard choices, don't think twice about me, suggested Gary. The power source for this body won't last forever. At best, I am on borrowed time here. If there are any sacrifices to be made, let me be the one. The young mage grimaced. I'm not giving them anything else. They've taken enough. I'm getting my dragon, and all of us are coming back. Keep it in mind, though, said the machine. Things never go as planned. They're the ones who need to worry, said Matthew. If things go badly, it won't end well for them. I'll make certain of that. The rest of the week passed quietly for most of the residents of Castle Cameron, but Matthew continued working steadily. He did make a few changes, under pressure from both Karen and his family. He kept a better schedule, stopping at the same time each night and sleeping late. The work would be done when it was done. That would determine when he left, nothing else, and no good would come from rushing. He had both Karen and Elaine assist him on a few occasions, their respective gifts being useful for some of the enchantments he was crafting. He probably would have been able to succeed without them, but it greatly improved his progress with less time lost. Even Moira left her self-imposed exile to visit his workshop, though he had nothing for her to do. He showed more patience than usual with her, answering her questions and generally being more sociable than he had been in the past.
You're in a good mood, she noted.
He shrugged.
I think it's the work, she decided. You always did like a good project.
This is important, he stated. It's not just a project. She waved her hand at the workbench.
Look at all this stuff. How many different enchantments have you made? You're right. It's not a project. It's an obsession. He gave her an exasperated look, and then his shoulders sagged.
I just want it all to work perfectly. I think I have most of it, but this last part is making my head feel like it might explode.
Encouraged by this opening, Moira put in,
Maybe if you told me about it. How would that help?
She glowered at him.
I'm not saying I'll figure it out for you, but sometimes framing the problem for someone else helps you to sort the problem out in your own mind. Try me. I'll listen.
Matthew looked doubtful. In the past, he had found her to be a poor listener. Most of his explanations seemed to bore her.
I promise, she assured him. I'll pay close attention. Tell me what you're doing.
He waved his hand at the metal circle that lay on his bench. It was small, a half-inch wide band of polished metal that was 2 inches in diameter. Both sides were inscribed with tiny runes that covered almost the entire surface.
I'm trying to get it to move after I activate the main enchantment. The problem is, there isn't much space left on it for more runes, and the motility part is turning out to be harder than I expected.
Why do you want it to move? She asked. The people on Karen's world have an uncanny ability to find us wherever we appear. I want to leave this somewhere after we get there, but I don't want it to be destroyed. If I could find a way for it to move a significant distance in a short period of time, that would be enough to keep them from finding it, he said, relating the problem.
Won't they just find it after it moves?
Matthew grinned. Uttering the activation command and touching it, the ring hummed briefly with Aethar and then vanished. To Moira's senses, it was gone, not just visibly, but to her mage sight as well.
That's a neat trick, she exclaimed. It's just like Elaine's invisibility.
He nodded. I had her help create it. Trying to make it invisible to both sight and mage sight was almost impossible without her assistance. He picked it up with one hand, and his arm disappeared up to his elbow.
Whoa, said his sister. Am I going to have to stick your arm back on again?
Matthew laughed and pulled his arm back, showing it to her unharmed. The invisibility extends out about a foot and a half around it. It looks sort of strange when you see someone reach into it.
Why is it so much larger than the ring itself?
He sighed. Hopefully, to hide whatever magic I use to move the ring around after I activate it. She looked thoughtful.
One of my spell beasts could fly or run around with it, as long as it was small enough to fit inside the invisibility, couldn't it?
Yeah, but you won't be there to create one for me, and I'd kind of like it to be built into the enchantment, he told her. She sighed.
That's your perfectionist streak again. Everything has to be organized just so. Couldn't I make the spell beast for you right before you leave?
I don't know when that will be, he said, but then his eyes brightened.
Oh, that's so simple.
I should have thought of that before. Moira could tell he'd had his moment of inspiration.
I told you talking it out would help. What's your solution?
Give me a hand, he replied. I'll need your help after all.
Chapter 45
Dr. Tanya Miller stared down at her handiwork. She was in a virtual workspace that mirrored one in the physical world. Her actions controlled a multitude of robotic tools and a medical android in her lab. The lab itself was located in Whittington, Staffordshire, near the site of the old Whittington barracks. The base itself was now largely abandoned, but the UN Defence Ministry had maintained the medical research facility for work on ANSYS after the war. The machine that lay on the table wasn't properly an android in the technical sense. It was a cyborg, living tissue working alongside advanced microprocessors to give it the functionality she needed. Compared to the first generation of ANSYS detector units, this one was in a league of its own, and she couldn't help but feel a sense of pride in her work. She was still annoyed that she hadn't been able to use Karen's neural tissue. The girl had changed, and she felt that that change might have made this model more effective. Instead, she had been forced to use tissue from one of the clones. Her daughter was hardly unique. Tanya had collected samples from numerous Shi'ha during and after the war, and had grown a wide variety of tissues from them, though she focused on producing neural tissue. She had done much of her work on isolated organs, but in several instances she had produced full human-like clones. Karen was the only one that she had allowed to be raised as a normal human child would be, though. The others were kept unconscious, used primarily for harvesting the parts she needed.